This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
The night sky for December 2015. Well, no one can complain about not having long dark nights. I only wish that it was somewhat clearer. November, where I live near Manchester, has been pretty dire. Anyway, let's see what one should be able to see should the nights be clear. Well, after sunset, over in the west, the square of Pegasus is setting. Above, to the left, is Andromeda and the Andromeda Galaxy. And if you go back a couple of night skies, I do have a chart to actually show you how to find it. Moving upwards towards the zenith, we have the W-shaped constellation of Cassiopeia, and down to its left, we have Perseus with its bright star Murphak, and the star Algol, the demon star, because it actually winks. It's actually an eclipsing binary, and occasionally the brightness drops quite considerably. With binoculars, and preferably even with a small telescope, between the two, if you follow the line of the Milky Way which passes through them, you'll find what is called a double cluster in Perseus. It's a very, very lovely thing to look at, one of my favourite objects in the sky. Moving further down to the left, you'll come across a bright yellow star called Capella in our Auriga. Again, this is a rich part of the Milky Way. There are quite a number of what are called open clusters there, which you can pick up with binoculars. And then, of course, rising towards the southeast, we've got this lovely part of the sky. First of all, you'll see the Pleiades cluster, down to its left, the Hyades cluster, with a bright star, Aldebaran, actually lying in front of it. It's not part of the cluster. And below that, of course, is Orion the Hunter. The reddish star top left is Betelgeuse, the bluish star bottom right is Rigel. Three stars make up its belt, below which we have in fact the Sword of Orion, which includes the Orion Nebula. If you go down to the left, following those three stars with the belt, you'll come to the brightest star in the northern sky, which is called Sirius in Canis Major. Up to its left is Procyon, the single bright star in Canis Minor. And going higher up still towards the zenith, we have the two bright stars Castor and Pollux in Gemini, the heavenly twins. So quite a lot to see, actually, in the heavens. Well, what about the planets this month? Well, essentially, you've got to get up in the morning to see them. Jupiter, shining at magnitude -2, rises at about 0030 UT at the beginning of the month. It's lying low down in Leo, close to the boundary of the Virgo, into which it was going to move in January. By month's end, it rises about 2230 UT, shining at magnitude -2.2. As we get nearer to it, its angular size increases from 35.6 to 38.9 arc seconds. It'll then be due south and so highest in the sky at about 0500 in the morning. The elevation of 44 degrees, not bad, should be well above much of the atmospheric problems. You should easily be able to see the equatorial bands in the atmosphere and the four Galilean moons as they weave their way around it. Well, Saturn passed behind the Sun on the 20th of November, so obviously isn't visible at the very beginning of the month, but around mid-December it will be rising about an hour before sunrise. Now, sadly, it's lying in the southern part of Ophiuchus, just over 6 degrees above Antares in Scorpius. So its elevation, when on the meridian, will only be about 20 degrees above the horizon. Shining at magnitude +0.4, it'll be high in the southeast, or high enough in the southeast before dawn, to make out the beautiful ring system. It's now opened out to about 25 degrees. By the end of December, it rises about 2 hours before the sun, and we'll actually see it approaching Venus, as Venus is returning back towards the Sun. Mercury, at magnitude -5, it may be seen at the end of the month, low in the southwestern sky, as it reaches greatest elongation on the 29th of December. It'll lie about 20 degrees from the Sun. It'll only be a few degrees above the horizon at twilight, so the use of binoculars and a low horizon will be needed to spot it. But please don't use binoculars or look there until after the sun has set. Well, Mars is another morning object. It rises in the east about 2 hours before the sun at the start of December and about half an hour earlier as we move into the new year. It brightens from plus 1.5 to plus 1.3 magnitudes and will be nearly as bright as a spica in Virgo when it passes about 4 degrees up and to its left on the mornings of the 23rd and 24th of the month. It passes close to the double star Porrima at the beginning of December, and on the 12th and 13th skirts the fourth magnitude star, Theta Virginis. By the 10th of the month, Mars' angular size will have reached 5 arc seconds, so it's not really going to be very easy to spot any details on its salmon-pink surface. By the end of the month, it will have reached an elevation of 28 degrees above the southeastern horizon as dawn appears in the sky. If we wait a few months until May next year, when it's closest to the Earth, its angular size will have increased to 18 arc seconds, and that will be greater than at any time since 2005. So we hope to get some good images and see some features on the surface then. Well, finally, Venus. Well, it's been dominating the morning sky for some time now. It's moving back towards the sun, but still by month's end, rises almost 3 hours before sunrise. A telescope would show that the angular size reduces from 17.5 to 14.5 arc seconds, but at the same time, the illuminated percentage of the surface increases from 66% to 75%, which is why the magnitude only drops from minus 4.2 to minus 4.1. Venus will lie some 5 degrees from Spica in Virgo at the start of the month, pass by the double star Alpha Librae on the 17th and 18th, and be very close to Beta Scorpii as we reach the new year. Well, what about perhaps the highlights of the month? Well, pretty obviously, it's perhaps the first really good month to view Jupiter. As I said, it's lying low in Leo, but it's still reasonably high in the ecliptic, and hence when due south at an elevation of about 45 degrees. It's looking a little bit different than it has in the last few years. The north equatorial belt has become quite broad. The great red spot is currently a pale shade of pink, but also appears to be shrinking in size. Interesting. Let's see if it continues to do that. For a while, the south equatorial belt vanished completely, but it's now returned to its normal wide state. And if you go on to the night sky website of the university, you'll find a diagram showing you the various belts and bands and so on that you can see there. Now, we have a comet beginning to grace our skies. It's called Comet Catalina. It's heading upwards this month towards Arcturus, which it will reach at the end of the month, that's in the constellation of Bootes. Initially, it'll be lying close to the Virgo-Libra border, so it'll be fairly low above the horizon, but it's heading north at a rate of more than half a degree a day, and by month's end, as I said, will be very close to Arcturus. By the 10th of December, it will stand about 20 degrees above the southeastern horizon at 0600 UT, lying some 6 degrees above Venus, so that's actually a good day to look for it. So simply find Venus in binoculars and slowly sweep up and to the left to find the comet. A little fuzzy blob. The best guess as to its brightness, and you never really know with comets, is about fifth magnitude. So not really visible to the unaided eye, but should be easily visible in binoculars. And just a few things where the planets and the moon come together. On the 4th of December, before dawn, you'll find Jupiter 2 degrees above the third quarter moon in Leo. On the 6th, Mars will be just 2 degrees from the waning moon, also in Leo. On the 7th or 8th, Venus will be close to the moon, within 5 degrees of the waning crescent moon. That's just as basically the moon passes down through the positions of the planets lined up in the morning sky. Perhaps the real highlight of the month would be on the mornings of the 14th and 15th after midnight, the Geminid meteor shower. We should have a chance of seeing the peak. It's a good year because there's a waxing crescent moon and that will not hinder our view. Obviously, an observing location well away from towns or cities will pay dividends. The relatively slow meteors arise from debris released by the asteroid 3200 Phaeton, That's actually unusual because most meteor showers come from comets. And as you might guess with the title, the radiant where the meteors appear to come from is close to the bright star Castor in the constellation of Gemini. If it's clear, it'll be cold. So wrap up well, wear a woolly hat, and have some hot drinks with you. I do hope you see some. I will, but I'll be a long way away and not able to take any images. After midnight on the 22nd, 23rd, there might be a chance of seeing some of the Ursid meteor showers. The peak rate isn't that great, but occasionally you do get a few more, so it's worth having a look. Sadly, the moon will be just before full, so I suspect only the very few of the brightest meteors will be seen. The radiant lies close to the star Kokab in Ursa Minor, so look northwards at high elevation.
Thanks for that, Ian. And for our listeners below the equator, here's Haritina Mogasano with the night sky where you are.
Welcome to December. My name is Haritina Mogasano, and today I am your storyteller from Space Place at Carter Observatory in Aotearoa, New Zealand. The name December comes from Latin, meaning the 10th. In ancient times, it was the 10th month from the beginning of the year in March. December for most of us is the time when we prepare to celebrate together another rotation of Earth around the Sun. Of course, whilst modern life standardization and globalization sees more and more people adopting this convention, it was not always like that. Different cultures celebrated the New Year at different times of the year. The Romans and their ancestors, the Thracians, had it on the beginning of the spring. If I think about it, it makes sense. It is the time when nature comes back to life. But what about a place where all is evergreen, like the North Island of New Zealand? Here in New Zealand, the Maori New Year is a lunar celebration, which occurs around the shortest day of the year. That is June, July. December, on the other hand, it's the month of beautiful red pohutukawa flowers, the New Zealand's natural Christmas tree, remembered in the arrival of the Maori ancestors when they gazed upon the land and witnessed its full bloom in action. Today it is associated with hot weather and parties on the beach, including Christmas, which is celebrated with barbecues and jandals. To someone who is used to 4 months of snow from November until February at minus 20 degrees Celsius, having Christmas in the summertime seemed a little odd, to say the least, and it got me thinking, where do calendars come from? What do people see when they look at the stars and the moon? And what do these celebrations mean for us in general? And what was their connection to the land? In the northern and central Europe, people have 4 very distinct seasons. Summertime can get as hot as 40 degrees Celsius, and wintertime can go to almost minus 20. That is very cold. So why did they choose to live there? Maybe it was the abundance of food in the summertime. Maybe it was the beauty of the landscape. Truth is that they had to overcome 4 months of snow and freeze, year after year. How did they know how to provision their food to last until spring? They harvested grains in the summer, and in autumn, the most important elixir, the wine, was on its way to the cellars. They needed to know when midwinter was so they could sacrifice their wild boars. Their meat would sustain the people until the beginning of the spring. This is where the saying of chewing the fat can be attributed to. Winter solstice thus became the most important milestone for those people. How can you measure it? The moon big and round and changing patterns once every 29.5 days did not really help in figuring out the middle of the winter in that part of the world. There had to be a better way. This is why they have developed very precise sidereal calendars. In Thracia, those were designed following the Saros cycle, the cycle that predicts solar and lunar eclipses. Closer to the equator, the year is measured with lunisolar calendars. In the Middle East, the Muslims have a lunar calendar. Their new year is marked by the Ramadan, which is precisely calculated by the phases of the moon. In the Far East, the Chinese have a lunar calendar too, and they also use Jupiter to mark the time, which is why the Chinese zodiac is on a 12-year cycle, exactly the time it takes Jupiter to move around the sun once. In India, they also have a lunar calendar, and Vedic astrology is based on the mentions of the moon, also known as nakshatras. The lunar mentions once were very important in observational astronomy, especially in that of Arabia, China, and India, and of Kiva, the ancient Koramia, and Bokhara, the ancient Sogdiana, and it is believed that they originated from Euphrates Valley, Coptic Egypt, and Persia. The mentions were 27, but usually 28, and possibly long antedated constellations, or even the solar zodiac. Their antiquity is proved by the fact that there, and probably elsewhere, the list began with the Pleiades, when those stars marked the vernal equinox. The Pleiades that are so beautifully distinct and close to the ecliptic so that everyone who can see the sun and the moon can see the Pleiades too. The moon is very important around the tropics for measuring the time, as it should be. The first thing that my daughter saw on the sky was Luna, Marama, the moon. It is big, it is easily seen, and it has phases that inform many cultures about the passage of time. Truth is, at the tropics, the temperature is very hot compared to the northern and central Europe. People did not need to measure the middle of the frozen, snowy winter time with the precision of a surgeon, like we did in Europe, but they did need to know when the tropical season began, bringing typhoons and other erratic weather patterns. This was done with the help of the moon and certain groups of stars. Equally ingenious, it's the Maori way of measuring the time. The Maori calendar is called Maramataka. Maramataka recognizes the phases of the moon with such precision that each day has a designated name. It begins with the observance of the heliacal rising of Matariki, that we know as the Pleiades, in June, following the new moon, which marks the beginning of the Maori New Year. In Maramataka, each day has a name that also instructs on the activities that are primed to undertake, cultivate the land, fish, or navigate across the ocean. The Maori realized that there was a direct link between the moon and the tides, and planting and fishing were also very closely associated with them. The Maori have a very special relationship with the moon. They use the moon and other celestial bodies to determine time throughout the year. This enabled the safety of their navigation across the oceans and the safe cultivation of their foods. The moon in New Zealand is of a rare beauty, as it is birthed from the ocean, or it appears from behind the mountains. It appears also upside down to someone like me, who is from the other side of the world. One of our listeners told us that he's always watching the man in the moon in the northern hemisphere. I remember watching him too. And he was curious, what do we see in the southern hemisphere? In New Zealand, the Maori see Rona Whakamautai, Rona the controller of the tides. One evening, Rona traveled down to the river to collect water, but the moon disappeared behind the clouds, and she cursed the moon. Marama the moon heard the curse and said, "Why curse such beauty when you belong to it?" and lifted Rona up to become the woman of the moon. You can see her laying down after she tripped in the dark of the Danaya tree with her water calabash behind her head. And the Naya tree is right in the front of her. For me, I was told once by a school group that there is a rabbit in the moon. I love the kids' imagination and I always look for both the rabbit and Rona in the moon. Back to our stars of the southern hemisphere and the wanderers of the night sky, the generic Greek name for the planet, Mercury is the only planet in the evening sky. At the beginning of the month, it appears as a bright star setting in the southwest an hour after the sun. It moves slightly higher in the twilight, setting 80 minutes after the sun by the end of the month. In a telescope, it looks like a tiny gibbous moon, a moon between first quarter and full. The brightest true stars are in the east and south. Sirius, the brightest of all the stars, is due east at dusk, often twinkling like a diamond. Left of it, it's the bright constellation of Orion. The line of three stars makes Orion's belt in the classical constellation. To southern hemisphere sky watchers, they make the bottom of the pot. The faint line of stars above and right of the three, it's the pot's handle. At its center is the Orion Nebula, a glowing gas cloud nicely seen in binoculars. Rigel, directly above the line of three stars, is a hot blue giant star. Orange Betelgeuse, below the line of three, is a cooler red giant star. Left of Orion is a triangular group making the upside-down V of the Hyades. Orange Aldebaran is the brightest star in the V shape. Aldebaran is one of the four royal stars. These royal stars were regarded as the guardians of the sky in approximately 3000 BC during the time of the ancient Persians in the area of modern-day Iran. The Persians believed that the sky was divided into four districts, with each district being guarded by one of the four royal stars. The royal stars held both good and evil powers, and the Persian asked them for guidance in scientific calculations of the sky, such as the calendar and lunar solar cycles, and for predictions about the future. Other names for the Hyades were the little she-camels and were forming the second nakshatra, Rohini, in the Hindu astrology. Still further left is the Pleiades cluster, impressive in binoculars. It is 440 light-years away. Pliny talked about them. In cauda tauri septem quas appellavere Virgilias. At the tail of the bull, Virgilias calls seven. The Pleiades seem to be among the first stars mentioned in astronomical literature, appearing in Chinese annals of 2357 BC. Canopus, my favorite star, the second brightest star, is high in the southeast. Low in the south are the pointers, Beta and Alpha Centauri, and Crux, the Southern Cross. As we talked in the November Jodcast, end of November, beginning of December, it's the time when the Grand Canoe of Tamarereti is in the sky. The bright southern Milky Way makes the waters in which the canoe is anchored, with Crux being the canoe's anchor hanging off the side. The scorpion's tail is the canoe's prow, and the clouds of Magellan are the sails. The Waka of Tamarereti, the canoe of Tamarereti, was marking the times when the waters were warm and safe enough for the Maori to sail back to Hawaii, their homeland. The Milky Way is wrapped around the horizon. The broadest part is in Sagittarius, low in the west at dusk. It narrows towards Crux in the south and becomes faint in the east below Orion. The Milky Way is our edgewise view of the galaxy, the pancake of billions of stars of which the Sun is just one. The thick hub of the galaxy, 30,000 light-years away, is in Sagittarius, now low in the west. The nearby outer edge, it's the faint part of the Milky Way below Orion. a scan along the Milky Way with binoculars will show many clusters of stars and a few glowing gas clouds. The clouds of Magellan, Large Magellanic Cloud and Small Magellanic Cloud, high in the southern sky, are two small galaxies about 160,000 and 200,000 light-years away respectively. They are easily seen by eye on a dark moonless night. The larger cloud is about 1/20th the mass of the Milky Way galaxy, the smaller cloud is 1/30th. Formaldehyde, or Hashtarang, as it was known to the ancient Persians, is also one of the four royal stars, and it's finding now its true home in the southern hemisphere. I remember watching it in awe from the northern hemisphere as it was showing the secret passage to the south to those who knew how to read it. Very low in the north is the Andromeda galaxy, seen in binoculars in a dark sky as a spindle of light. It is bigger than our Milky Way galaxy and nearly 3 million light-years away. Jupiter, Mars, and Venus are all in the morning sky. Saturn joins them at the end of the month. At the beginning of December, Jupiter rises around 2:30 a.m., reducing to 12:30 a.m. by the 31st. It is a bright golden-colored star shining with a steady light. Venus is up around 4 a.m., a brilliant object bright enough to cast shadows in dark locations. Mars is between the two bright planets, looking like a medium-bright reddish star. Jupiter and Mars rise steadily earlier while Venus stays put in the dawn. In the second half of the month, Mars is near and passing below the bluish-white star Spica and the brightest star in Virgo. At the end of the month, Saturn emerges from the dawn twilight below and right of Venus at the bottom end of the diagonal line of planets. The crescent moon will be close to Venus on the morning of December 8th. A small telescope shows Jupiter's disk with its four big moons, like faint stars lined up on each side. They change sides from night to night as they orbit the planet. Jupiter is 794 million kilometers away mid-month. The Gemini meteor shower peaks on the morning of the 15th. The meteor appears to come from the constellation of Gemini, low in the northeast at midnight, moving to the north by dawn. The meteors are clumps of dust from a comet. Friction with the air heats them up and makes the air around them glow. This concludes our Jotcast for December 2015 at Space Place at Carter Observatory. Special thanks go to Peter Detterlein, Chief Astronomer of the Mars Society, Alan Gilmore from University of Canterbury, and to Toa Nutone Witeareiwaka from the Society for Maori Astronomy and Traditions. As the Maori say, E fiti anana fetu o te rangi, the stars are shining in the sky, ko takoto akenei ko papa to anuku, whilst Mother Earth lays beneath. May you enjoy the end of another happy rotation around the sun. Kia kaha and clear skies from the space place at Carter Observatory in Aotearoa, New Zealand.